Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a molecular tour of adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. Now, I've done a series of molecular tours on two tracks. One is to improve my delivery, sort of develop some techniques up, and on another track I've sort of been working through molecules, and this is sort of the pinnacle sort of molecule for me, ATP. So ATP is the energy molecule which powers the protein nanomachines inside of you. Now, a lot of people think, oh, there's just muscles, blood flowing, pumping, but if you actually really get down inside a cell, so there's 23 trillion cells inside you, so that's 23 million cells inside of you. So that's a hell of a lot of cells. So inside each cell, incidentally, is 2 meters of 2 meters of DNA material code, about 3 or 4 gigabytes of information used by the cell. But that's the primary information. The information is edited and noted to actually give the cells the individual characteristics or responses. So there's that and more inside a cell. But ATP is the energy of the cell, and let's talk about what it can do first. Let's first say that what school says is at school, or what the average people learn, is the vintage atom. This is the flat atom with a little nucleus and electrons going around it. And with that, it's impossible to understand things or understand how proteins are made. When you actually think of a protein, the atoms are more like bionical parts. They clip together. They fill up space. The electrons fill up space. They have joints between the atoms, bonds between the atoms, which can flex and move. And if you have the right joints and the right shapes of atoms put together, you can actually make a little mini robot. And indeed, there are inside your cell a little mini robots. Some of them open and close doors. Some are a little pair of trousers, like out of the wrong trousers. And they go along and they hook onto sacks and actually walk down roads inside your cell. Now, you may find this hard to believe, but if you really want to see the YouTube, The Inner Life of Cells, it's the music version of it. The Inner Life of Cells is by a Boston animation company, but there's now large animations where they actually go through a path. They actually back out of the school textbooks where they're just simple line drawings and the atoms are little dots with circles going around it. They back up. They just feed it into supercomputers. The supercomputers put out the motion of individual cells, and this is fed to, I suppose, animation similar to Toy Story style animation, but much, much more. So you can actually get down and actually see a cell. Now, what would it look like? Well, light doesn't operate here, so it's a sort of fantasy world. They expanded up to the size of cells. The standard expansion factor is by a billion. So if you expanded cells, so atoms by the size of a billion, an atom would be sort of a large, not a novelty tennis ball, but in between, like a novelty mini basketball would be the size of an atom. And a series of these things together would be actually a fairly large thing, like the size of a car, like a size of a very large robot made of these cells. If you expanded one of these mini robots inside of you, robots. There's kinesine, there's actin, there's all these things. If you look at how muscles work, these little legs go out and stroke on a ladder in a muscle. So how a muscle works is that there's these muscle fibers. The muscle fibers respond to calcium when it's injected into a muscle cells. When you inject calcium into a muscle, calcium ions into a muscle cell, you get these muscle fibers twist and put out little rungs, and there's all these little feet which run against each other and actually contract. Muscle cells can only contract. When you put in calcium, these rungs come out and these little feet move. So all these robots inside of you are all based on quantum imagination. They're based on quantum physics. They obviously operate on that, but your imagination, to be enabled, you have to be able to be taught and trained what an atom looks like in quantum mechanics. And when you put them together, you've got atoms as large, fluffy balls which contain space, and the interaction between them by joints, and the joints can either be flexible or they can be fixed and rigid joints. And of course, when you get a flavour for this, you want to go in and see these rigid sections, because this sort of makes up a really hard part. And also, again, in quantum mechanics, different atoms can actually absorb an electron into the inner guts of it. And this is a podcast I've done, and I think it's fairly interesting in that it's called a podcast on something called electron affinity. And this is something a bit different from electron negativity, which is the sort of tug of war between atoms, which atom is going to tug the electron more off, and that's a fairly easy thing to work. So electron affinity is sort of like electron negativity is like a quality score, and I think Pauling had a quality score of 4 as the most electronegativity, 4, because it's the number that came into his head. It turned out that his, what he called 4, they measured it as 3.98 for fluorine, is the most electronegative stuff. And you can sort of imagine that in classical physics. But in quantum physics, you have this thing called electron affinity. And I'm going to mention this because it's really important to understand what ATP does. And we'll discuss it in a little sec. But electron affinity is, if I've got a neutral atom and I have an electron come up to it, the electron is not repelled by the neutral atom because it's equal stuff, but I can actually get that electron and actually push it over the top of the atom. And the electron, bear in mind, in quantum physics is not a point, but I want to actually not mention it's a cloud, because people think clouds of individual droplets of moisture make up the cloud. It's more than that. It's got an extended existence. So it eases into existence and out of existence. And that existence is described by function. It's a wave function. So when you put the wave function of the electron over the top of the atom, it can actually find a home there and actually jump onto a neutral atom and release energy. And that release of energy is electronegativity. And so you've got carbon with a certain electronegativity, oxygen with a fantastically strong electronegativity. It loves electrons. Nitrogen has almost no electronegativity. It's just completely happy by itself. I'm just telling you this in advance. And this electronegativity is similarly in the different blocks of the periodic table. You see the electronegativity drop in the very center of the block. So in the D block, electronegativity drops to the middle to really low at manganese. And the equivalent point on the the D block is the central block, the transition elements. But in the non-metal block, the P block, that group of, 6 by 4, 6 across and 4 periods down at least. Let's see, probably 5 periods. Oh, let's see, 3 to, well, you could really argue it's 4 periods across there, but that block there has a minimum electronegativity around nitrogen, and you'll have to store that array. So we've built up the idea so far of yourself. So this is, molecule is about you. And this molecule, which is called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Okay, and it's something that you can believe and imagine and understand. And I've got to understand it by following several tracks a long way. And we're going to talk about this molecule. But before we've got talked about this molecule, we've got to, it's used by something, and I'm building a picture of what it's used. So inside of you, if you expand yourself by a factor of a billion, your cell would be the size of a, not a skyscraper, a five-story building, a fairly large five-story building, a sort of a warehouse. And inside this warehouse are machines operating the entire thing. How else does this cell work? It operates by machines. And these machines are very active, intelligent. Oh, they've got a sort of inbuilt intelligence. And you would be amazed by the amount of activity. And inside the machine, inside your cell, expanded by a factor of a billion, I suppose would be a 3-5 story little warehouse. Inside are these little walking legs, and they walk around the place carrying big sacks of chemicals left, right and centre, following instructions. There are other cells which lock into things. There's all these things that are operated, and say inside your DNA, it's a feast of activity. So inside the middle of your cell is another little sphere with these little holes in it for material to enter and leave, chemicals to leave in it. It's sort of like a super busy central command post. But inside your DNA are these other machines which flex and move, and there's things reading your DNA which can spin at the speed of a jet engine, that incredible speed, and it all does mechanical parts, and all these machines, nanomachines. Why aren't you told about them? Simply because your teachers were not taught about it. It's recently been discovered, and your teachers are in general teaching you to do well in an exam that they sat. And of course, the world has moved on, and things have moved on. It's no longer dreadfully important that you answer those questions. As a scientist, I can say there's a general hostility. If they look over your shoulder and say, "Oh, what are you looking at? Oh, I'm researching this," there's this big bit of a huff and looking away, and they really close down conversations once you start to say, "Hey, look at this." But welcome to this podcast. Welcome to listening into an enthusiastic person talking about ATP, and you are of trillions of cells. I think it's about 26 trillion cells. I might be wrong. Again, look, I should do a little bit of background. I've over the last 18 months, I've had 2 heart operations, and each time I've had a heart operation, my brain's been completely reset, and I've had to build up and talk about things. So this is why I'm doing it here, and I'm sort of just basically relearning, rebooting the periodic table into my head, and rebooting chemicals into my head, and rebooting quantum physics into my head. And there are this beauty inside your body. Yes, I should say this is why I can't quite remember. I haven't committed to memory the total number of cells inside the human body. And look, the bottom line is there's so many, we don't know. We're not sure. It really depends on the size distribution of cells. So there's papers on it. So that's why I've said, I can give you a podcast, and I cannot be quite sure of it. But one of the things I am sure is that the inside of your cell is infinitely more fascinating than what you learn in grade 7, which is these static things which are floating there, sort of like a Christmas decoration, or a little diorama, you know, where everything's still. So you can imagine your toy diorama, you have your toy army soldiers, stuff like that. And although you can move the little tanks and people around the place, it sits there, and if you walk away, it just sits there. But a cell's not like that. A cell is alive and moving and responding to things. So just to give you a little picture going in, say if you drink some milk, it's got lactose in it, and in your stomach, there are certain cells which have been, the DNA has had little markers moved on it, exposing various things, and there's a little marker which, when the lactose comes in, the little marker gets sucked up into the lactose and bonds with the lactose, releasing the DNA to do something. And what that does, it means that your DNA or nucleic acid, that double helix stuff, it releases it, and it releases it, it unleashes a writing, and the DNA sends off strips and messages and messages, and the messages get sent to little machines which operate, like little robotic machines which go chunk, 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 and it goes across and makes a digestion enzyme for the lactose, and your lactose gets digested. It's as simple, but it's complex, and it's fundamental at that. And all this is being powered by machines. Now, you know that if you have a toy, you need batteries, and ATP is the battery of the cells, and indeed it is a battery, but it's also a rechargeable battery. Now, imagine you have a toy that you're operating, and inside your body is trillions of cells, and inside each cell is thousands upon thousands of machines. So this is an unimaginably large number of machines. All, every time they work, for every little thing, every step they want, they use a whole battery. So you can imagine the number of batteries you would use, and each battery is ATP. So what happens is a charged battery is called ATP, and a discharged battery is called ADP. So what is it? Adenosine triphosphate, and when the battery is discharged, the phosphate gets broken off to PO3, phosphate ion, and it's a diphosphate. So one of the phosphates gets lift off, and this battery is used, and it's thrown away. So if we have so many trillion, you know, thousands, billion, trillion batteries being used in a day, easily those batteries have been used in a day, you're probably using it now, and if we add those up and pile them up, what would be the weight of those batteries? Say if you didn't have a recycled battery, what is the weight of shopping bags to have full of those? You can imagine it's double A batteries, you know, coming in. What would be the weight of it? And here's a bit of information. If you were to happen to eat sufficient ATP, and they're not rechargeable, if you had to use them and throw them away, you would use your own body weight in batteries every day to stay alive. This is an unthinkable amount. So the ATP gets recycled all the time. So it's, the battery gets charged and recharged, and we have to talk about it. And indeed, it is a battery. It is, has a charge stored in it. It gets recharged up, and when it goes in and clips into your nano machine, the nano machine gets a small jolt of electricity, a small pulse of electric field, and the electric field moves, and it charges parts of the protein. The proteins get repelled to each other, and they move. And when they move, it's like a real battery. And it's not as complicated as gears and stuff like that, but it is forces and charges. It's like a little charged force inside, and you can always imagine the sparks coming along. So in your way of thinking of it, think of a ATP as a little a charged battery with a little spark in it, and when the spark goes out of the battery, it goes to ADP, and the spark goes away. So your ATP is an incredibly, incredibly important molecule. Now, I know you think you eat sugar and food, and so what happens is the sunlight comes in to a plant, and it photosynthesizes, and it stitches carbon dioxide, which is CO2, onto water. And so what, essentially, if you just look at the carbon loses its oxygen, O2 off, and the water goes in, and it goes HCOH to carbohydrate. The carbon gets hydrated and the oxygen goes off. And this is sugar. And of course, we can't use sugar. Just get that across. When you eat a sugar cube, you go, yum, you don't use that sugar to move a single piece of your muscle. No sugar has ever moved a piece of your muscle. Now, what first goes in is the sugar and the fat. It gets converted into, broken down into glucose, some really small things, by 2 kilograms of or compost in your stomach. You feed your compost dump inside your body, and it heats up, and the compost dump puts basic, very small molecule juice into you. So if you eat a steak, that steak has to be broken up into tiny little proteins, tiny little atoms, and it's put into you, and your cells can't use it. But your cells does exactly the same thing. The sugar can get transported into your cell. So the fundamental unit of life in you is a cell. It's a little bag, a double fat layer of bag. I can't quite describe it for you. It's a bubble of water inside a bubble of fat. There you go. You are a real bubbly person because you are made of little bubbles of fat filled with a bubble of water. So you can press yourself, press your fingers together. It's that squishiness. You're squishing the squishiness of your actual bags of fat. So unlike a plastic, if you want a water bomb, you have a rubbery bag and water inside it. This is a very small fat bag with a bubble of water inside it. So if you shake up mayonnaise or water and fat together, you shake it together, you see these little fat bubbles going in. Well, if you could actually inject a water bubble inside the fat bubble, you'd make essentially a cell. So this is your cells, inside your cell has something which digests the sugar. So inside you have something which digests the food and makes it into basic sugars and stuff like that. But inside the cell, there's basically a little stomach of the cell, and it digests the sugar, goes chomp, 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 it uses oxygen and sugar, digests it and produces recharged ATP. So your little, these, and inside your cell, although inside your stomach are lots of bacteria, they're good flora, but inside your cell are captive bacteria, and these are slave bacteria, and they get there by being born again. As a cell births itself, it also births itself slave bacteria. So you are a slave master. You're slaving ancient bacteria in every one of your trillion cells. One, sometimes thousands of these slave bacteria. And these slave bacteria are fed sugar by your cell. Your cell can't use sugar. Your cell feeds these bacteria sugar, and these sugars recharge up the ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and uses a phosphate with it and sticks it to the adenosine diphosphate to make adenosine triphosphate. And now what we're going to do now, for so many minutes in, is give you a molecular tour of adenosine triphosphate. And to understand it is to understand a battery. So these are small little batteries with little handles on them, so they go in and they discharge their charge spot on your proteins to activate them, to make them jolt and move across. So yeah, I could do this. I could get a protein machine and I could get a tiny little probe and it would kick like a frog. And these charged batteries float around, and there I have got little magnets, sort of bonding type magnets. It's not magnetic, it's bonds, that sort of local bonds, which actually guide these batteries in. Like batteries in a toy, there's places for the batteries to go in. They go in, they release their charge, and then release their attractiveness and free and go off again. And it's not a random type of stuff. It's not like you've got your toy there and you just throw batteries at it and occasionally a battery fits in. It's actually got mechanism to pick up battery and place it in, charge it and move off. It's a precision machine. This is engineering as you cannot never imagine it. You are a fantastic individual. Yeah, I think you should put 23,000 thank yous to each and every cell for doing a fantastic job. And so let's go. This ATP is actually charged up by your mitochondria. Your mitochondria is eating, munching through the sugar and oxygen, going burping out the carbon dioxide. And as it's doing, it's making the cell fuel, which actually makes your entire cell comes to life. Your cells do not use sugar directly. It uses ATP. ATP is described as a currency. And so if you go into a milk bar, or you go into a hotel and you go, "Hey, boy, come over here. Garçon, come over here. Pick up my bags." And you offer them socks. They'll go, "What?" You offer them a big molecule of sugar. That'll do. What? Nothing. You offer them, I don't know, a can of spray paint, a vegetable. Look, can't use it. Oh, just not that interested. You offer them money and they'll go. And so ATP is very similar to it. It's something which just makes the economy of the cell just race. You put a lot of ATP into a cell, it just starts clicking like anything. You take any ATP, your cell will just freeze. If you remove the ATP from a cell, it would be a shopping center before everything opens. Everything would be just quiet. There might be a guard here. You might hear a little bit of a noise, echo. But as soon as it goes up, the shopping center of your cell comes alive. The ATP is the key thing. It's the money of the cell. It's the currency of the cell. And we're going to do a tour of ATP. So it's adenosine triphosphate. So I did a tour earlier of adenine, and I've said adenosine is adenine plus ribose. Ribose is a sugar. And we've got plenty of time here. And then, of course, there's phosphates to add onto it. And it's a way to go. So I'm going to go quickly through the adenine, which is a base. And it's a nitrogenous base. It does not mean it is a basic thing. It's not like basic, like it's not like caustic soda basic. It's base as it's a fundamental. That's what they really mean by base. And it's the 25% of your DNA in terms of code. It's the A. So A and T go together, G and C go in together. I'll start to look at it. But Addison is the most fundamental, and it's a real combination of CNs put together, cyanides put together. If you mix some cyanide together with a bit of electricity, you know, the right things, these will pop out quite naturally. So adenine is being found inorganically around the place. It's one of these organic molecules which spring up in an inorganic context. And if it's made out of CNs, it shouldn't be a surprise to you that it's made out of 5 carbons and 5 nitrogens. And and hydrogen's just to block it all off. And it's got the classic structure, which I've talked about over and over again. There's so many things. It's a hexagon with a pentagon put onto one side. So what happens is, I want you to imagine the hexagon, vertically, sitting on your table, and if you put it so it's got a vertex of the hexagon, it will topple over, and let it topple over once, so it's sitting a flat side on the flat bottom of the table. This is what I call a flat, horizontal, or a hexagon at rest. So you can have a dynamic hexagon, you can have a flat hexagon where it's sitting down. So say someone gave you a box of chocolates in a hexagon pack, I'm sure there are things like that, and you were to rest it, you have to rest in an unstable way with the hexagon, the vertex pointing down, well, you can actually rest it on its flat side. You're resting on its flat side, then you've got a flat top on it, so you can imagine it's sitting flat and you've got a flat top. On top of that, you put a pentagon. That's a five-sided figure. So what happens is you've got a vertex really sticking out to the right, a vertex sticking to the left, and on top of your pentagon, you've got a vertex on the surface of it all. Now, in that, we'll just go through, going down, you've got a carbon, then left and right, you've got a nitrogen, and then you go down to two carbons. So that's your pentagon. And then you go around that bottom. You've got four atoms to make out the rest of your hexagon. So moving off to the right, you have a carbon, then a nitrogen, then a carbon, then a nitrogen, and then back in again to the carbon at the bottom of your pentagon at the top of your hexagon going around. And sticking off, it's just a little bit of an aside, sticking off the first carbon of your hexagon as you go around is another nitrogen, an amine group. So that gives you two in the upper ring, two in the bottom ring, and one added on as a nitrogen, and that's called a nitrogenous base. And those nitrogens, with their oxygens, form hydrogen bonds, which forms the bond, which is the internal zipper of your DNA. But there's more. Now, the important thing here is up on your pentagon at the top of your adenine. Adenine. Adenine is this next thing we're going to talk about. Is on those two nitrogens, one nitrogen has a hydrogen on it. The left one has a hydrogen on, the other one doesn't. It's got a double bond instead of a hydrogen. One of the things is that we're going to talk about this. Let's have a look at this adenine in a moment. Now remember, as I said before, that nitrogen is just not interested in electrons. So if you put electrons up into this molecule, you put charge or you push charge up into this area, it's going to say, thank you very much, I'm just not interested. The electrons will pull. If you put additional electrons up the top there, that's just, it's not going to hold it. It's sort of like putting giving shopping to someone with no arms. Yeah, they'll say, thank you very much. All the shopping is, say you get someone, who's got no arms, and you just throw a few balls at them, and the balls just drop off them. Whereas someone who really loves it, like oxygen, loves electrons, and will actually tuck the electrons away inside the middle of it. It's got no electron affinity. So if you put electrons there, the electrons, will be at high energy, or higher energy, and will want to move away. Of course, if you have something which wants electrons which want to move away, that's what a battery is, right? So your adenine is critical for what a battery is. So it wants to move away. So if you put a love-hate relationship, sort of, you put different characters in the car, you can set it up and flick a switch and they start shouting at each other and energy happens. So this is the fundamental basis of a battery. This is a nano battery for nano machines. A rechargeable nano battery which is used for nano machines inside you. This is just fantastic stuff. Why don't we teach it? Well, let's not worry about that. You're learning about that at the moment. So that's adenosine. So one, adenine. Adenosine is this next thing I want to talk about. So you've got ribose. And so let's forget, before we leave this, we've got the nitrogen on three nitrogens associated with your bottom hexagon, and you've got a nitrogen, two nitrogens with your upper pentagon. In that upper pentagon is a hydrogen. Now, we'll put that aside for the moment. So just remember in your head, when I say hydrogen, you'll know what I mean, because I'm talking about that hydrogen right up on that adenine molecule. So just remember that, and we'll go to ribose. That's great. Ribose is a sugar. So you got fructose, sucrose, ribose. Now, essentially, any process involved with photosynthesis will produce something of C. It used to be CO2. C brackets O2 goes to C brackets H2O. Or, in other words, HCOH. But the C now has two bonds with it. And so a carbon has two bonds, so rather than two double bonds, it's replaced with a single bond to the carbon, a single bond to the OH, a single bond to either carbons. It makes a little chain together. It's this beautiful thing, like stitching together. You know, when you get parts together, Lego parts together, you can actually build it and free up spaces and allow you to build a little tower. And these sugars are these fantastic things, and one of the things we'll have to stop is tell you how it makes bonds. And the fundamental thing is that I have the building parts and I make a bond. When I make a bond, in general, as a rule, making a bond, any chemical, organic bond, when you make it, this is a general rule. I don't know, it works with proteins and so many things. It works with these, particularly sugar. When you make it into a big thing, it's casts off water. And we're going to talk about that in a little while. But ribose is a 5-carbon sugar. There's 6-carbon sugars and 5-carbon sugars. And it goes like this. You've got a carbon with a hydrogen, and so a carbon, it starts off with a carbon with a hydrogen and hydroxide OH with it, and it goes four in a way, four with an H and OH on each of them, so always go 1, 2, 3. By the fourth one, something special happens there to make it into a ring, which is so fourth one, we're going to remove a hydrogen. I suppose it depends how old it. We have on this an OH, and what we'll do is we'll remove a hydrogen from that OH, and remove an OH from our very first. We'll move our hydrogen from the first one, and we'll take it apart such it will go like this. It's almost hard to describe. You'll have to see it yourself. It goes carbon, 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 four carbons, and that carbon is re-hooked back to the first carbon. The fourth is connected to the first by an oxygen. So a chain of carbons with an oxygen in the middle of it is an ether. That's the name of it. So you can actually remove a carbon and add an oxygen in it. And so it's a five-membered ring with carbons in it. Or four carbons and an oxygen in a ring, but your fourth carbon has another carbon and hydrogen and OH. You'll have to see it to go through. Now, the important thing is that your first carbon also has an OH on it, and that OH goes up to your ribosome adenine, and that OH reacts with the hydrogen, and the water comes off it, and onto it sticks your adenine molecule. So your ribose and adenine together gets called adenosine together. So your adenosine has a sugar, which, as far as I can see, tends to buffer electrons away from it. But the adenosine, if it has electrons or pushed up onto it, or charge pushed up on it, can hold it. It's almost like a little capacitor up the top there. It's where it's sort of where the electrons don't like being. And so let's go through it. We've got the ribose, which goes pentagon with the apex of the pentagon being an oxygen hooked together, and on each carbon is an OH, but the first carbon's OH is actually ripped off and replaced with a adenosine molecule. The adenosine molecule is cooked. If you can imagine the pentagon as sort of a head and the hydrogen as on that adenine as a little ear. That ear is lopped off and it's actually got the sugar bound together. So we've got the sugar and a base. And the sugar and base together is the sort of backbone. The sugar there's a sugary sugar phosphate polymer string with these bases hooked onto the sugar. And that's how it goes together. Now, the important thing, so if we're working back, and you'll probably get a picture of it, we then have an OH sticking a C, a carbon, I suppose alcohol group. It's an OH and a carbon and an H sticking off as a sort of the fifth carbon. So four carbons make the pentagon with the oxygen, which hooks between carbon four, or you should say carbon two, or carbon two and carbon five. Or I sort of see it back to front, I see carbon one and carbon four. So it's either carbon one or carbon five. And that, it's got the hydrogen rips off that, and that bond forms with a phosphate, which is PO3, and you have an oxygen hooked into it. And this is a really fascinating thing that goes on, is that your carbon gets hooked to a phosphate, and a phosphate, as it's hooked on together, is a PO4, a P, which is like a nitrogen. It's got bugger all electron affinity, but it does form these fantastic bonds, which can't, quite honestly, cannot be described at all sanely using school.physics, Lewis.physics. It's, the phosphate has four oxygens bound to it, So let's go to working around. I can see it in front of my head. And this is what I'm trying to do. This is the basics thing, so is to flex my memory. We start again off on the extreme right. We've got adenine, and the adenine is hooked to the ribose, and the ribose is hooked to a phosphate. The ribose pentagon is hooked to the adenine pentagon, and the adenine pentagon is the reef on top of the hexagon, I suppose, room. So you've got these two hexagons, the two pentagons linked together, and they're linked together by the dehydration. It removes the water from it. And then from this, in that pentagon, you've got another methyl group, a methyl, or it's a carbon and hydroxide group, that carbon and oxygen H, that gets attacked or linked into a phosphate group. And this is something which is really, really fascinating. If an electric charge goes into that phosphate group, it actually drops down into, if the electric charge is allowed in that area, that electron drops down and produces 20 times more energy. It's got 140 kilojoules per mole, and a mole is 602 billion trillion atoms. Okay? So if I get 602, that's the Avogadro's number, billion trillion atoms, and of these, and I get the same amount of charge, and I just throw the charge together, it will produce 141 kilojoules of energy. That's a fair amount of energy produced here. I don't know whether it would be a pretty big explosion. Now, it's, say if it was on nitrogen before, which only produces 7 versus 141. That's an awful lot of energy. So that's the crux of the energy storage. It's keeping the, setting it up such that the charges, can flow together and release energy that way. It's like a battery. Your battery, the electrons have to actually go through a circuit to get around to actually fall in closer to a nucleus. The only way that electric charge releases energy if it falls in closer to a nucleus. And how it falls in closer to a nucleus is via quantum mechanics. The actual shape of the electron orbitals is a more meaningful shape with respect to the shape of the other molecules, which have other electrons which happen to be around that nucleus, and that's why the elements which have a ordering of a filling up of shapes is that next shape in which releases so much energy. So nitrogen, it's a pretty even keel. It's got a low electron affinity, similar to manganese in that periodic table. I would expect there's an equivalent dip in the S block and an equivalent dip, but much more subtle, in the F block. But this is the major thing. This is, you know, your body is using these quantum mechanical nano batteries which go into power your nano machines inside you. This is all true. Your biology teacher probably will not teach it to you. And what can I say? I can say I've had this enjoyment. You know, when I look at this type of stuff, they say, what are you looking at? And you know, what are you reading that? And I'm saying, look, I'm just really enjoying this. And there's real anger at it is. And so let's look at what the end result of this. There is a group of people who get really angry by this and resentful. And this is a discovery of mankind. And I think this always happens. that when you come up with cars or any sort of technological breakthrough, there's the initial large people who are angry, and then there's one, and then there's two, and then there's everyone. So initially people were against computers, they love computers, everyone can't do without it. Initially people are against this type of view of the atom, of cells and your life, and I just happen to be one, and I sort of accept that, well, look, I'm just enjoying it if you don't understand it. But now I suppose I'm going back to part of this rehabilitation, trying to communicate, exercising it, and I'm enjoying it. And this is for you to just sit out and just enjoy the nano batteries powering nano machines powered by the power of quantum mechanics. Is what's not to enjoy. So let's recap. We've got the adenine, which is somewhere where you put electrons that want to move. You've got the ribose, which is your architecture, your things which hold these two things apart, your sugar apart, your building blocks, and so both these things are occurring naturally. Then you've got your phosphates, and your phosphate is PO4, and your PO4 is actually hooked, your first PO4 is hooked onto your ribose, the dangling fifth carbon of your ribose, and if the electrons go down there, that's really, really great. And what happens is that's called AMP. There you go, AMP. I don't know what Australian Mutual Proprietary, some sort of insurance company, it's called AMP. AMP, but it's adenosine, which means the adenine and ribose, adenosine monophosphate. Then what goes on is that there are these basic recharge stations which recharge the mono to a di, and there's a bit of energy associated with, but there is a massive amount of energy of adding the first phosphates. So what, let's look at it. A phosphate is PO4, so a phosphate with oxygens around the outside. And I just have to really think exactly how this is done. Most of the chemical reactions, remember, is that the chemical goes out and gets replaced with an oxygen. As it goes across, and so this is triphosphate. So your phosphate is PO4. Now what is this? Actually quite a beautiful thing to do. You have two oxygens, a phosphorus, two oxygens, a phosphorus, two oxygens, a phosphorus, two oxygens, a triphosphate. Now what happens is that the two oxygens of the phosphorus gets peeled off, and so you can either have two or three. Now the process of doing that is that these phosphates are attracted to a negative charge, and the negative charge is pushed up the machine. And there's nothing more that you can say. It's a sort of battery. It's a sort of machine. It's got this docking station with its. It's a fantastic thing to observe. But there is a molecule which is in the mitochondria, which chews through a sugar, produces with the sugar, gets a sugar and oxygen together, and as it does it, it clicks on to a adenosine diphosphate and makes it a triphosphate. And as it does so, it physically pushes this together and makes this charged, unstable molecule. This unstable molecule flies out of it here. Now it's doing that for fun. This is sort of like a pedigree bacteria. A bacteria, sort of like cows. You know how cows in nature produce a little bit of milk, and we've produced these amazing genetically engineered cows which we feed grass and we get milk. We can't eat grass, we get the milk from it, and these have been genetically engineered to produce this aplomb, you know, and the best of these have been moved across, and it's been stored as a special sort of subspecies DNA. The DNA of the mitochondria is separate from your DNA. You have actual bacterial DNA which has been transferred from your mum. It's not from your dad. Your dad, sperms don't transfer this DNA. This is purely by the female line, this DNA. It's not like DNA of the all squiggly wiggly bit inside your nucleus. This is outside your nucleus, and they're in hoops because it's bacterial DNA. Bacterial DNA is not squiggly wiggly in the nucleus. There's no nucleus in bacteria. You've got these hoops of DNA, and they make it. And so these machines actually recharge your batteries. And as it does so, it creates something which has an electric charge in it. And I don't know whether currents actually flow or electric fields flow in it. I haven't really thought about it. And there are aspects, it's one of the things is that if you know a certain amount, if you've got a certain amount of interest, you have a certain amount of imagination, and once you imagine it, you imagine it again, and then it comes back, and you think, oh, there's more that I want to know about it, and there's more that I want to know about it. Although I can just see that the charge, the electric charge, somehow is put up there, the electric field is placed such that the phosphorus wants to stick, the phosphate wants to stick on it. When it's discharged, the phosphate drops off. It's not, there's energy in the breaking of the bond. Energy breaking the bond is localized to the bond, right? So if you store energy in a bond, a localized bond, that's the only place you can extract the energy of. What this is an entire stretched, sprung molecule. It's sort of like a molecule which is sprung, ready to go. And it's sprung. The only forces on molecule are electric charge, electrons, the charge, it's sprung, and these sort of coiled up springs go out, get pumped out by your mitochondria, go around the cell, and your proteins have these docking stations for these springs to come out, and they spring, and the charge goes across, the electric field goes across, giving you the energy to it. So every time your enzymes spin at the speed of a jet engine around your DNA to mass produce a copy of the DNA or do these things at enormous speed, lightning speed that you can understand. It's powered by these quantum mechanical nano charged. You could think of it like a battery, or you can think of it like a twisted up spring. It's all pretty much the same thing. And when you actually come to think of it, a capacitor, if you hear a capacitor, you can actually hear a capacitor discharge, indeed, because the capacitor discharge, the energy is stored in elastic energy of these two surfaces pulled together by the charges. It's all the same. So these nanomachines are being produced and coming across. Let's just review a game. There's actually three separate components, and unfortunately, in the way that I memorize it or visualize it, I have the phosphates on the left and the adenine on the right, and the ribose in the center. That's pretty much the, and the ribose, it's a bit like a, it's like, you could think of it a bit like a pentagon teapot but the tea spout is that last fifth carbon, and that's pointing off to the left. So let's go in, I'll go from left to right, then right to left. From left to right, going full left is adenine, which is your base, nitrogenous base, where the charge ain't liking to be. It has to be It's pushed up there. And that's look, it's a necessary part because it ain't work without it. Okay. And that's got a hexagon and a pentagon, and the pentagon of the nitrogen on the pentagon, one of those nitrogens in the pentagon has a hydrogen, and that hydrogen is lopped off and reacts with an OH of the sugar. So water comes off and the sugar is bound, and the sugar is a little pentagon with a extra carbon on it. The extra carbon's like the tea spout on it, and the lid of your coffee pot, your teapot, is an oxygen. And an oxygen bound between two carbons in a carbon chain is an ether. This is a fantastic, fantastic thing. And I'm straining to think of how the charges go in it. I'd love to do supercomputer calculations on that. But nonetheless, it's there. So we've got those two structures. So if you can imagine, it's like the battery casing, in my view, is the sugar. It's holding things together. And it's got this base in which it's got necessary storage of charge, but it's an unhappy storage of charge. Basically, a battery is a conflicted thing. It's got chemicals. It just wants to react. It's got to find a way to react. That's why I think, if you're a battery which is completely happy, completely reactive, completely unreactive, it's dead. It's not, ain't going to do anything. It's maybe, it basically will be a trick of wood. Inside it's got very reactive chemicals. It's got metal which wants to oxidize. If you look inside your zinc battery, the zinc goes from zinc metal to zinc oxide, and the other surface of it goes from hydrogen plus to hydrogen gas. Your C cell battery or whatever, A cell battery, is producing hydrogen gas, and the hydrogen gas is going off. So the H plus is going to metallic H or H2, and your zinc is going to zinc plus. So there's an iron transport there, and the electrons have to complete that traffic. The electrons can't get through the gel in the center. You've got this electron keeping away gel, like sugar. Sugar is something which doesn't transport electrons too well. It's of a battery form. Now, I don't think there's actual fact of flow of charge. However, charge does flow in a certain sense. There's not a complete electron move, but electrons are pulled in one direction. And this is the dipole moment. And a lot of these things, a lot of biology is this dipole moment. So we've got the adenine, the ribose, and onto the ribose, the left-facing T-spout of the ribose are it's PO4. It's actually two O's, a phosphorus, two O's, a phosphorus, two O's, a phosphorus, two O's. And that is stored as a very strained molecule. One of the great things is it can't bend, because there's no bending allowed, because the oxygen is pinning the ribose together, and the other one's pinned in these flat structures. So it can't bend. If it could bend, it would just release itself. The phosphates are put there, and this is an unstable molecule. It's an unstable molecule by the artistry of your bacteria that you have enslaved to eat your sugar and to produce this ATP. This ATP is charged, and your ATP is going to cross, and this moves around the cell and energizes the nanomachines, which makes your cell alive, it makes you alive. Okay, so we've gone from left to right, so from the right to the left. Now I'm going to go from left to right. So I'm a bit dyslexic, I may have got this going out. And look, I probably won't actually put a post up here. And now let's go back again one final time. It goes 1-phosphate, 2-phosphate, 3-phosphate, sphinx or triphosphate, goes, hooks onto this T-spout, this is really sick, of a ribose sugar. A ribose sugar, remember, is a carbohydrate which has been dehydrated a little bit in different forms. It's been dehydrated once for the phosphates, twice internally to form an oxygen bridge across it to make it a nice, small, little, tight, water-soluble molecule. And then once again to hook it up to the ribose. So if you imagine your sugar is acting as a sort of super bonding platform. It's sort of like a meeting room for all these two things to come together. And then finally, you've got your adenosine, your base. It's a nitrogenous base. The one thing that it's asking, something it doesn't like to do, this is store the negative, incredibly negative energy of this phosphates, storing it a distance away. And this is exactly what you need for an energy storage device. You need to store the energy away from it. If you want to have a hydroelectric scheme, you've got to put the water uphill. If you want to have an April Fool's Day prank, it's best to put the water on the door, a bucket of water on the door above the person who's going to walk in. So when they open the door, the bucket falls down on them. It's storing of potential energy. And the store of potential energy, so the sugar gets put into the potential energy of these batteries, and these batteries go around. And you will do the maths, trillions of cells with thousands of ATP in it. So thousands of trillions of ATP a day, and you get the answer, this staggering thing, that you go through your own body weight of ATP a day in just being alive, just you being there. You have actually consumed your own body weight of ATP, but it's not that bad because the ATP gets used again and again. And of course, watching we can actually watch NMR by looking at the phosphate. We can watch the muscles react and use all these things. Courtesy of the scientists, there's little bits of science which are a little bit difficult, and to get, that is a little bit of quantum mechanics, a little bit of molecular physics, a little bit of physics to go across. Each little bit by itself is not worth it. It's easier to just teach people what's always been taught and teach them to redo the test you did in the 80s would be the sort of thing, the test you've done in the 80s, and you have this great feeling that the students of 2020 are able to do the science well of 30 years ago, and that would be a great thing. However, we've discovered other things, and it is a great thing to enjoy, and I must admit, I very much enjoy it. However, if you want to not enjoy it and keep, you know, and not look at it, what can I say to someone who doesn't want to understand it? I just, it's sort of like having this, the equivalent, I think, would be having your friends come along for a drink at a beach house, and the beach house is in the bush, and you have to walk a good 300 meters to the surf beach with his surfboard, and they just want to play Scrabble because they've always grown up playing Scrabble. They want to sit around reading the old books inside the beach house, and it's time to pick up your quantum mechanical surfboard and surf the knowledge waves out here and you're going to get wet, you're going to get dumped. It's going to be things that you don't understand. However, it is a world of life and of incredible beauty. Look, really, the molecules inside you are incredibly beautiful. They're not boring molecules. They are alive, fantastic molecules to look at. It's like watching your diorama as your kids. Your toys come to life. It is really Toy Story inside you. What more can I say? And this is a rant podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.